This episode is sponsored by a company who has truly found a solution to an age-old problem, and that is Carna Bunker Gear. One of the most prevalent conversations in the fire service is, should we or should we not train in our bunker gear? Now, the answer to both is yes. As most of us are aware, the carcinogens from structure fires, of which there are over 260 that are dangerous to human health, not to mention the PFAS and other chemicals that are within our gear from the manufacturing process, are factors that we obviously want to minimize. Now, the other side of the coin is that we do need to train in our gear. There is no way to acclimatize the heat retention and lack of mobility than to actually wear the gear. So seeing this problem himself, firefighter and exercise physiologist Ryan Conley developed a carcinogen-free gear at a much lower cost that can be used in non-IDLH atmosphere and training that does not require puncture or tear resistance. Now, as someone who always trained in gear myself throughout my career, I wish this technology was around then. And I got to test it personally while coaching my tactical athlete class a few weeks ago and can testify that it not only simulates the heat retention of frontline gear, but also the lack of mobility, which is imperative at operating at a high level on the fire ground. Now, some additional benefits include being able to doff the gear when you do get banged out for a call, increasing the lifespan of your frontline bunker gear, and then also public education. Think of the number of times that we allow, for example, school children to wear our gear when it's infused with all these carcinogens. So there are so many real-world applications for a fraction of the cost of IDLH-rated bunker gear. So if you want to hear the whole story behind this, listen to my conversation with Ryan Conley on episode 1175 of the Behind the Shield podcast, or go to carnabunkergear.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show neuroscientist, board-certified psychiatrist, and the inventor of Apollo Neuro, Dr. Dave Rabin. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from the relationship between sleep deprivation and mental ill health, the neuroscience behind suicide ideation, an incredible insight into the application of pharmaceuticals and where they're being abused, the healing power of psychedelic medicines, the incredible non-invasive technology he's developed to help with mental health and PTSD, and so much more. Now, before we get to this amazing conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,200 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. Dave Rabin. Enjoy. Well, Dave, I want to start by saying two things. Thank you to everyone at IHMC for making this initial connection, and we'll get to that organization in a little bit. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I'm in Monterey, California right now.
Beautiful. Well, I normally take a deeper dive into someone's life, but I know we've got a shorter amount of time, but I think there's a lot of value in even understanding how you got to where we are today. So let's start at the very beginning. Tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Sure. So I was born in Mill Valley, California, just north of San Francisco. And I have two younger brothers. One who is now in law school and the other who is a physician. And, we, you know, grew up in a family where generally speaking, curiosity was highly encouraged. Asking questions was highly encouraged, which was really nice. And I don't think I fully appreciated how nice that was at the time, because how could you as a kid? But as I got older, I started to realize how much that impacted my way of thinking and my drive to learn about the world, and helped me really understand from a young age that learning was something that took place all the time, not just when you're in school. Like, school is just the school stuff, but then there's everything else that you learn all the rest of the time of your life. And learning just doesn't just stop at school. If school makes you hate learning, then it's really done a terrible job of what it's supposed to be doing, right? So I think, so that was really helpful and helped me get through my like academic school years, because school is actually quite challenging for me. And I always found myself like very distracted, very much like wanting to like socialize and also be like learning the next thing before it was being taught. And so that was school was tough, but I think thanks to my parents and who are both also physicians and researchers, they really helped to cultivate a really nice like learning environment for us growing up.
One thing that's really kind of been glaring recently in these conversations is what seems to be the enemy of critical thinking would be all things that challenge mental health. So stress, sleep deprivation, et cetera, et cetera. And I think I've said this on here several times. I think that COVID and how that was perceived and received by the masses was a great multi-million participant study on what happens to an overstressed population when asked to just simply stand in the middle and critically think. So with that being said, what are, through your eyes, what are the challenges of the resistance to critical thinking, the resistance to, like you said, the being the journeyman learner rather than staying in the parameters of an academic space or maybe a corporate or profession space?
I mean, there's so many endless challenges to critical thinking. It's a funny question. I'm actually writing a book about this, and because it's such a multifaceted area, you know, part of which is that if I was to kind of summarize it succinctly, it is that we have, on one hand, we have a few like core drives of being a human, and they are we need sleep, we need food, we need water, we need air, we need shelter from predators and from the environment, and and then connection, right? Like those six things are basically like the six core things that we absolutely require to live as sane, functional, happy, healthy human beings on this earth. And we have a survival system in our nervous system called the sympathetic fight or flight response that is designed over hundreds of millions of years and evolved over hundreds of millions of years. But interestingly enough, it's still quite similar now as it was, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago in the ancient sea snails and reptiles, which turns on automatically in response to potentially threatening or threatening things. And we have done this incredible job in our environment in our drive for convenience to eliminate potential actual threat, right? Like, we don't have lions and tigers chasing us very often. We rarely have predators chasing us. We rarely have to worry about being, having enough shelter from a storm or from the environment. We generally have enough people around us in terms of human connection. We have smartphones with social media that allow us to actually like expand our human connection if we choose to use it for that. So like, we are the most connected, convenient generation of human beings ever to exist on this earth. And you can experience that by reaching out to somebody immediately with your phone and getting together or, you know, ordering something on some website and having it delivered to you from anywhere in the world in 2 days, right? Like, we've never had that before. And yet we are about to screw it all up. All that goodness that we have, we are about to screw it all up because we are so caught up in the like dopamine driven attention economy of social media and smartphones, technology, and all the things that it's used for to sell us stuff or to capture our attention as a product that is commoditized, that we have become addicted to technology. And addicted to smartphone technology in particular, which is around us all the time, but screens as a whole And when our attention gets sucked away into anything like that, that's on a regular basis, that's not present, we are literally giving up our, especially when it's unintentional, we're doing, you know, it's just doom scrolling or endless, you know, meaningless shopping or like whatever it is to distract yourself from not feeling good using your phone or your whatever device, you're out giving away your power by handing your attention over to someone else to decide what it gets to focus on. And then whatever it focuses on in those moments is what comes into our consciousness, becomes part of us. And so long, you know, it's hard to explain in short form, but ultimately I think it's like our drive for convenience and comfort and avoidance of discomfort has slipped a little bit down this slippery slope of, you know, what happens when we start to become too reliant on technology for those things? And are we losing the ability to cope ourselves? Are we losing the ability to learn new things ourselves or to do hard things? Because we're so focused on being able to feel good instantly with our phones and distract ourselves from hard things that maybe we don't need to do hard things anymore. But it's important to learn hard things to grow and become a person, right? Like you have to be an effective person. We have to do hard things. It's not a question. It's known fact, scientific fact, right? So I think that's kind of like the real conundrum that we're facing as a society right now.
You touched on sleep, so I'll just walk through that door now. This is obviously a dead horse that's been flogged for 9 years. You and I first met in IHMC when we did a blue sky for Marion County Fire Rescue, which is the county that protects my family. And when we were in that presentation, you know, the thing that I brought to the room was the impact of the way that we work our firefighters, the 56-hour work weeks, then the mandatory overtime that ends up being 80, et cetera. Without taking too deep dive into that whole conversation, talk to me about the correlation between sleep deprivation, especially chronic, and all things mental ill health.
Well, so stress on the whole, you're talking about burnout for one, like burnout is the culmination of tremendous overwhelming amounts of stress over time. And we call that like allostatic load, like how much force is being put on the body over time. And when that level of stress itself impairs sleep, and we are designed evolutionarily to not be able to sleep, and particularly to not enter deep and REM sleep states, the most restorative sleep states, when we are under threat, when our body perceives threat. And our amygdala, the fear center in the brain, doesn't know the difference between being, you know, call shifts or maybe being called for a shift or, you know, all the different things that can happen when you're on call at the fire department, and an actual immediate survival threat. Because a lot of the times, a lot of the stuff that comes in the fire department is an actual survival situation. And so in those particular situations, specifically with like first responders, doctors, military, police, firefighters, EMTs, we get extra conditioned to respond with to basically not be able to settle down and to stay in a heightened state so that we can tackle an emergency that could come in at any moment. But there isn't an emergency every moment. And so the stress of that memory of this could be it could be an emergency right now or at any time, and which is future thinking, sets our body sympathetic nervous system into a fight or flight response as if there were a predator around the corner at all times. And so our bodies say, nope, we're not allowing you to get deep restful sleep. That's where sleep paralysis happens. That's where you're so out of it, you lose control of your body. You can't possibly be in a situation where you could lose control of your body or be paralyzed when there could be a threat around, right? Even if it's just a possibility of a threat, the body shuts that down. And that's one of the biggest reasons why people have poor deep and REM sleep is because their stress response system's overactivated. And so people who have been especially first responders, been working in these jobs that have an extremely high stress level in terms of the day-to-day work, and they're working crazy hours, and then they also don't have enough like really great recovery time and or practices. If a lot of people just go to their phones, right, and start scrolling like as soon as they get a break, that is not calming the body. That's adding additional allostatic load to the body. It's additionally stimulating. So it makes it even harder to sleep when you finally get that chance to go and lie in bed. Your brain is still hyperactivated and spinning. So does that kind of answer your question?
It does. Well, I think one of the biggest myths in the fire service from the outside looking in is, oh, well, you get to sleep at work. And I've always used the analogy, when you sleep at a fire station, it's like the guy in the orchestra that has the big cymbals and he's whispered in your ear, I'm going to smash these in your ear, but I'm not going to tell you when. How well would you sleep? And that's it. Yes, they might be unconscious for periods of time between calls, but you are not getting the deep restorative sleep that's going to process the learning, it's going to heal all the training that you've done and make your ligaments, tendons, and muscles stronger. And it's not going to process all the thoughts that you've been through, including the traumatic thoughts. So every third day, you are degrading, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the gist. We need, and I think that's one of the things I talk about a lot, is we need that deep restorative sleep. It's not optional. If we are putting ourselves in work or lifestyle situations that have dramatically impacted our sleep, and our sleep is under 6 hours a night, especially as a major sign regularly, and we're getting low amounts of deep and REM sleep, then that is a recipe for burnout over time. Because we need sleep is like our number. We're supposed to spend a third of our entire lives on Earth asleep, right? Like, we are not even close to that, and that is like our body's deepest, safest, restorative state. And when we have to get into that state, that's like going to the gas station for your car, right? Like, it's the best gas we've got is sleep. Food is like, obviously, or maybe food is the first best gas. Sleep is second, most important, but close second. So we really need to like make sure that we're refilling the tank.
Absolutely. Well, just going back to your journey then, you have physician parents. What was it that sent you into the world of neuroscience and psychiatry?
Well, it was kind of a funny story. So when I was a kid and very, very young, like probably between the ages of like maybe 5 and 9, I started to have these really vivid dreams. And I didn't really understand much about what dreams were, other than the fact that I know I would like wake up like surprised or shocked of like what I had just experienced. And as I started to go to school, and they were really vivid dreams, like they were so vivid that I would have a dream that I was like hanging out with my brother doing something. And then I would be hanging out with my brother the next day. And I would mention, hey, do you remember that thing that we did? And he'd be like, what are you talking about? And I would instantly remember that was a dream, that he wasn't actually physically there. So these were really vivid for me. And as I got older, I started to notice that, especially as I, started talking to, seeing patients, many people have extremely vivid dreams. But as a kid, you don't know anything about it. And so I didn't think much about it. It was just interesting. And then when I started to go to school in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, I started to have more like darker dreams, more nightmares, still vivid. And those became pretty scary. And so I started to ask my parents, because I wasn't feeling that great about and that excited about sleep, like, what are dreams? What are nightmares? Why do we have them, et cetera? And, I think to calm my mind and ease my thoughts around sleep, they said something that most parents say, which is like, don't worry, dreams aren't real. They can't hurt you. And that was innocuous enough at the time, but I kept having occasional extremely vivid dreams, and they feel real, right? Like, it felt as real as waking reality for me, as an experience. And I think that was really fascinating and made me start to question from a very early age, if this feels real as waking life, maybe the adults don't understand what the word real really means, right? Maybe we need to put a little more like inquiry into that word. Because if they're describing an experience, this feels real, So what is it? What is real? So that's kind of like where it started for me. It was very young. And then I started to just kind of percolate on that thought, and then I started reading a lot of science fiction as I got into high school, and started to become really interested in studying dreams scientifically, and started to find like some Carl Jung and some psychology stuff. And my dad took me on a walk one day. I was probably in like 10th or 11th grade, and I had really admired my parents' passion for medicine, because they did some research and they spent some time doing research in their careers. They also saw patients, and they primarily saw patients, and they saw a lot of patients who couldn't afford care for free and provide a lot of charitable medical care to the community, particularly like the poor immigrant community in San Francisco. And that always, and they were so happy about providing that service. I always saw like how great they felt when a patient who couldn't afford, like we were eating like a rum cake that a patient, an Italian patient who couldn't afford care, like bought him to as a gift for saving her vision, you know, and allowing her to see again. And I know it was just like a silly rum cake, but he really felt so good about having been able to help this woman, even though she couldn't pay for what, you know, the service was actually quite expensive that he was providing. And that left seeing the patients and how happy they were, you know, when they could all of a sudden see again and never thought that was possible, really left a mark on me. And so I always had that in mind, but never was sure that I wanted to go to medical school or be a doctor in my early years. Started doing some research in high school in the lab and started to see that doing research was really cool. Started, you know, going to work and see patients with doctors shadowing. I thought that was interesting. And then my dad takes me on this walk in like 10th or 11th grade. I think it was 11th grade. And he was like, what do you want to do, son? What do you want to do with your life? And I originally wanted to be like a professional baseball player, but those dreams had kind of faded. And I was thinking, you know, like, I really want to study dreams. So I told him, and he's like, well, that sounds interesting, but you're never going to be able to make a living doing that. And if you want to do it and you want to do it like to the best of your abilities, you'd be much better off going to medical school and becoming a doctor so you can see patients and then actually work with them with their material, their subconscious material and their dreams. And then you can always do research on the side as much as you want. But if for some reason your research doesn't work out, you can always go see patients and make a living. And I was like, this is practical advice. So thought about it and I applied to a medical school, and then during medical school and college, I was continuing to do research and found that my mentor, Dr. Sally Temple, who had just won a MacArthur Prize for her groundbreaking research in stem cells. And she offered me the opportunity to leave medical school, take a leave of absence for a couple of years and do a PhD with her and continue my research in a more dedicated fashion. And when that opportunity came up, it was hard to say no. So I took a leave of absence for a few years between 3rd year and 4th year of medical school, and then did my PhD in neuroscience and stem cell and aging, and then came back, finished medical school, and then realized in that last couple of years of training that one of my colleagues, I was actually still thinking up until the last 2 years of my training, I was still going to be an eye doctor because I spent most of my time doing aging eye research. And then one of my good friends, I had a great psychiatry rotation. One of my good friends in medical school, who we spent a lot of time together talking about consciousness, said, you know, Dave, you really need to consider being a psychiatrist. You'd be a great psychiatrist. And I was like, honestly, I've never really considered that before. Because at that time, psychiatry was quite a stigmatized field in medicine. A lot of people didn't respect psychiatry, even back in that 2010 time. It's not that long ago. And so I never really honestly considered it. And then she sent me 10 of the top papers that had come out in psychedelic medicine research, basically with psychiatrists and neuroscientists studying psychedelic drug-induced waking dream states and consciousness. And I was like, holy crap, this is 10 papers in top tier publications. This is 2012. And it just overnight, I was like, this is it. This is my field. I'm going to become a psychiatrist and do this work.
Before we jump into psychedelics, because we're about to, stem cells, I've heard kind of conflicting areas as far as, you know, what they can do currently, what we're hoping they can do, and then some of the mythology around them. As we sit here now in 2026, where are we as far as the exciting potential of stem cell therapy?
I think there has always been an incredible amount of exciting potential with stem cells. You know, theoretically infinite potential because they're stem cells. But I think the idea being that, you know, we really are just scratching the surface. And I think part of the challenge has been in the way that the therapies are administered and the rules governing the regulations around the quality of the therapies. And a lot of people are still getting their stem cells from Mexico and from like other, you know, international sources, and the quality is not guaranteed in any way or preserved in any way. And then there are other companies that are doing stem cell work, autologous stem cell work, like from your own body, and they're, you know, turning those stem cells either sometimes in some cases umbilical or in other cases like peripheral stem cells, and turning them back into totipotent, you know, induced pluripotent stem cells, which is really incredible. And then delivering those back to the body and seeing great results. And so I think there's a ton of exciting stuff that's already happening with stem cells legitimately in the regenerative medicine field, especially orthopedics. There's incredible work and incredible data on orthopedic use of stem cells to repair injury faster. And most professional athletes who make their living doing as professional athletes today, when they get a severe orthopedic injury that could benefit from stem cell repair, stem cell facilitated repair, they get it. And it helps accelerate recovery. So that's really cool. A lot of other things, it's kind of overstated for at this point, but there's more evidence coming out. And I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there. I just think we need to standardize more so that we know we're working with the same material at baseline, and then do more studies of that baseline material that's pure.
Absolutely. It's exciting because I'm missing cartilage on both knees. My meniscus said jug handle tears bilaterally, and one day I'm hoping that they'll be able to get those to grow back. So that's why I'm asking. All right. Well, then talking about psychedelics, that would be amazing. I mean, that's the, you know, minute thing. Obviously, the brain would be phenomenal, and the spine, another one. So before we even enter the world of psychedelics, the traditional route, and I say traditional, the modern medicine route when it comes to psychiatry, talk to me about what you were taught on that track, and then let's talk about the pros and cons of what we know as pharmaceutical, you know, antidepressants, et cetera, that are available at the moment.
I mean, I can answer those questions together, which is that the core of psychiatry, biological psychiatry, which is what we call it, over the last 50 years or so since we started to, you know, releasing and using SSRI antidepressants in treatment, which really ushered in the kind of current era of psychiatry, is really focused on stabilization. So stabilization is important, but it's just one phase of the entire treatment course or illness course for an individual. And when we think about stabilization for a physical injury, we think about, oh, you just got into a car accident, you're bleeding out from your legs. We need to get you into the hospital, and we need to get you into the ER, and we need to stop the bleeding, and we need to get you biologically, you know, physiologically stable so that then you can heal, right? And we do that so quickly because not only can you die, but we can see the injury. We can see you bleeding out, and we can see the injury that needs to be fixed. In mental illness, you can't really see the injury, which is a bit of a problem for Western medicine in terms of how we approach it, because it has the same risks that physical injury has. It can still kill you, right? It just won't necessarily kill you right away. But mental emotional injury that we don't like allow, we don't stabilize properly, can stick around if we don't do anything about it, and it can still kill you. But you can't see the injury. And so what often happens is we ignore it, or we're just told it's our fault, deal with it, right? Don't let it happen again, like any of, or anything in between. And so this compounds the injury inside. And then that injury, just like a physical injury when not treated effectively, can become infected, you know, gangrenous, festering gangrenous, like it can, you, and eventually like we amputate parts of our emotional selves from access because they're so painful that we don't want to access them anymore, right? We don't want to go back and think about it anymore. So SSRIs are really great and many of the other medications we use today are great at stabilizing people in mental health crisis. And mental health crisis being you're about to harm yourself or somebody else, or you're in a really, really bad way and are just about to get to the point of harming yourself or somebody else. And then medications, or the medications we have, are are often very effective when used properly at stabilizing people in that state and getting them back to a near baseline state, to how they felt before they had this episode. A near baseline, not usually back to baseline, quite back to baseline being like, you know, how they were before they started feeling really bad. That's important. However, what we do in mental health, because we can't see the wound, is we just continue, and we have for the last 50 years, and I would argue this is one of the biggest challenges that we have that is caught, that is part of the reason why we're in the mental health crisis we're in right now, is because we don't have a next step after we stabilize you in terms of what medicines you're going to take next or what therapy you're going to do next. Like, we have suggestions for therapy. We don't require anybody to go to it. People, and so what we end up telling people is, you have to take these medicines for life. There's no cure for your illness. We can treat it and do our best to keep it in remission, but you could have attacks at any time, right? You could enter remission anytime. And especially if you stop taking your medicine, the evidence shows that you're much more likely to have an attack again. So effectively, you're putting the stabilizer on, you're putting the brakes on, the emotional window of awareness, you just put the brakes on there, and then you're just keeping them there for years. And what happens is, number one, people become tolerant to the breaks that are on or the sedatives. So then you need to add more distraction, add more numbing, add more stabilizer. And then people start to get a lot of side effects from those additional dosing of those medicines because they're not risk-free. And then people also start to have withdrawal effects when they stop taking them. And so what we're really moving, so that's kind of how the system is set up today. We don't really have a continuation after stabilization, which is a huge issue.
I had a Swedish psychiatrist on probably about a year ago now, and he was saying in Sweden, I think they were only allowed to prescribe for about 6 months, and it underlines what you're talking about. And in my world, it would be parallel to having a femoral bleed, me putting a tourniquet on, and then being, all right, just don't take it off. You're not fixing anything down the road. So it's fascinating the way that you frame that, because it really does illustrate the issue. And I would argue, you know, to remove mental health for a second, it's the same with, you know, hypertension and hypercholesterol and the diabetic symptoms is, yes, some of these pills can stabilize, but where is the exit strategy? Where is the conversation of, okay, we're going to get your blood pressure where you don't have a stroke, but now let's talk about meditation and exercise and healthy eating so that your body itself can get back to where it can maintain, you know, homeostasis when it comes to its blood pressure. So, you know, I've always said this, that they seem like they're a great tool, but just like you said, they're a bridge to whatever is next. And if there is nothing next, then as you alluded to, then you're walking around with the tourniquet now.
Exactly. And so that's where I think, you know, we're coming back full circle from this last half century of biological psychiatry to where we've marginalized psychotherapy, to one in which psychotherapy is becoming realized as essential to give people the skills they need to achieve the longstanding benefit of the healing experience from mental illness, whatever illness they have, by practicing techniques that help them cope with discomfort more effectively. And what we're finding is that if you just use the stabilizers, SSRIs, SNRIs, benzodiazepines, et cetera, to numb people to discomfort without giving them the coping skills and allowing them opportunities to practice those coping skills to manage and adapt to discomfort on their own, they never learn how to do it. And so then you take the medicine away and they're flooded with feelings again. They're like, I don't know how to, what am I supposed to do with all these feelings? This is a lot. Right? It's just overwhelming for people. And I think that is in large part, one of the major reasons for such significant withdrawal effects from SSRIs and SNRI antidepressants is just that feeling of being completely overwhelmed with sensation again and feelings when your emotional window has been narrowed and shrunk for often many years. But in the past, yes, we would prescribe for 6 to 12 months. Many places in Europe do this. And then you would give somebody the skill sets they need in that 6 to 12 months to be able to successfully taper off of the medicine and not have to take it anymore. And so that's the work we do in our clinic. That's the work that many advanced clinics in America are now doing and going back to, and that we're starting to teach more in institutions of higher learning. And that's really, I think, what in large part psychedelic medicine has to offer, because psychedelic medicine shows us that when you combine the neuroplasticity increasing, learning increasing, perspective shifting, biochemical experience that comes from taking a psychedelic with psychotherapy and the right kind of psychotherapy, you get these profound, long-lasting changes that only require a few doses of medicine compared to everyday dosing. And so you can achieve better long-term benefits with a lower side effect profile with certain psychedelic medicines used properly, like ketamine in therapy, which we can't currently see with existing antidepressant medications, which is very exciting.
Before we kind of take a deeper dive into that, one of the like startling commonalities with pretty much every single person who's come on the show who's either been right at that point of taking their own life or in some cases even gone through with it and survived their attempt. When we were young, a lot of the conversation with suicide was, it's cowardly, it's selfish, how could you, think of your family? And, you know, that's what I believed as well. And then you start listening to these people that were there. And there seems to be this common denominator that through the perfect storm of all things, all the factors that break down our mental health, unaddressed childhood trauma, sleep deprivation, organizational betrayal, side effects of alcohol, psych meds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there seems to be a miswiring of the brain to where their actual reality becomes distorted and they believe that they are the reason for the pain of their loved ones. And if they just remove themselves, which in that period of psychosis, I would argue is courageous and selfless, even though it's a distorted way of thinking, that if they just do that, everyone else will be happier. Now, the healthy mind knows that pain is passed on to the people that are left. And that's a whole different conversation. But that feeling of burdensome, that voice saying, you are the reason for everyone's suffering, I don't feel like that's discussed enough in front and center mental health conversations. And I feel like it should be one of the biggest red flags that if you're starting to hear that self-talk or you're hearing your friend speaking in that way, that that's a good precursor to getting someone maybe before it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is exactly what comes up in the trauma therapy we do with people. And it's also why, like, four of the most powerful words that you can say to somebody is, it's not your fault. You know, like, I think like everybody blames themselves for more shit than they need to blame themselves for. But people who are really in that sort of penultimate moment of despair have this often overwhelming burden that is, I think you use the right word. I mean, it is delusional thinking that I am the reason for everyone suffering. And if I was just gone, everyone else would live a better life, you know? And I think that's never true, generally speaking, across the board. Like, that's never true. There's always more we can do together alive to remedy a situation than when somebody's gone. And so, yes. And I think like when somebody can be reasoned with, right, then you can start to convey to somebody, hey, you know, it's not your fault. And, you know, there's a lot that can be done here to help you. But when it enters a stage of delusional thinking, reason kind of goes out the window. And I think that's why that wording that you use is actually really important, because that's when we start to think, well, like, okay, this person like really needs a higher level of support and care. Because we're talking about someone who has really been over rotating on these thought loops, what we call like distorted thought loops that you take over your mind. Right. And then you eventually like lose perspective that it could be any other way. You get so certain on it. So I think like that's when we start to see those, you know, that it's good that you brought it up. That's a really important thing to notice and really, you know, help people as an early sign, get into care earlier, talk to somebody early so that you can start to, you know, somebody who can challenge those thoughts. Right. The whole point of therapy is that you have somebody who's not part of your day-to-day life, who, when you say stuff like that, like, What if it's my fault that everybody else is suffering around me, right? And they're like, well, let's talk about that. Like, is that actually possible? Like, let's talk about your mom. And then you start to talk through, you know, and they're like, they come to their own realization that, of course, it's impossible for that to be the case, right? But without having a person to talk to about that kind of stuff is really sensitive. You know, it's hard to process.
What about the prevalence of childhood trauma? When we had, again, IHMC, we were talking about, you know, psychiatric screens at the beginning of a profession. It's, again, been incredible how many people I know that had multiple tours, that had super traumatic careers in the first responder professions. And yet when they have either, maybe it's traditional counseling, more often than not in these conversations, it is more the psychedelic journeys that they've done, that it was actually the formative years that really were the fractures in their foundation. So even when, but when you see the conversations in my profession, usually it's, oh, well, James had that decapitated three-year-old, that's why he's struggling. Not that when he was 4 years old, he was trapped in a house fire and almost died. Let's talk about right. that as well. So what about that? A lot of the people listening that are wearing a uniform, you know, talk to me about the prevalence of actually the early years being a big factor of their mental health struggles.
I think it's extremely prevalent. I mean, as a trauma psychiatrist, I would argue that it's much more prevalent than we talk about. And I think it's probably, you know, from what we know, I think it's not a question about whether or not there's a high likelihood of someone in one of these careers having childhood trauma. It's how bad was it? Right? Like, how severely impacted are they from that traumatic childhood experience? I would argue that pretty much everyone on the face of the earth has overcome some kind of, you know, assuming that you survived childhood, some kind of severe childhood challenges that could be classified as traumatic. I don't know a single person who doesn't have something like that. But I think the degree of severity increases pretty substantially, and the commonality of that severity starts to increase pretty substantially when you start to get into like the military and veteran populations and also first responders. And in a lot of cases, even physicians. And, you know, I think there's a lot of care people who go into the caregiver role in a field because of something that happened to them as a kid, where giving care, maybe they had to start caring for their parents early in life or do, you know, taking on additional responsibility that was not typical for a child. But I think that there's certainly a lot to that.
Supposedly, military first responders have an ACE score of 6 out of 10. And supposedly, the average incarcerated person has the same. So that then gives you that metaphorical crossroads. Did you have a positive mentor or a negative mentor in your life, but the same kind of trauma? Where I think there's an interesting conversation to be had is, having gone through numerous psych, you know, evals, I had to do the MMPI numerous times, which I learned down the road was never meant to be a standalone test to you know, see if someone's worthy of being a first responder or not. But what I realized is, if there's an acknowledgement that if you are towing the line as a soldier or a firefighter or a cop, that there's a good chance that you've had some struggles up to this point. And if, you know, addressed, I truly believe that becomes resilience and fosters empathy. If left unaddressed, I feel like it's the fracture of the foundation.
Yeah, it's the blind spot. It's absolutely the blind spot, right?
So reframing, rather than checking a box and saying, we tested to see if they were batshit crazy, they passed, so therefore we're good, I'm washing my hands of any responsibility. What about having the conversation of the same way that we do PT, that you literally normalize therapy sessions as you go through, you know, your formative year, your first probationary year, and then obviously checking in ever since, so that you can start working through whatever it is and view it with a lens of performance. Look, you will operate at a higher level in a gunfight, searching for a child in a fire, if we can get your mind, you know, working clearly. So rather than this, you know, you got over that hurdle, you're good for the next 25 years, having this conversation at the front door, so you've normalized it, there's no barrier to entry when, you know, when you do have something bad. And, you know, then down the road, you always know, well, I'm going to go speak to Dr. Dave because it's been a rough shift. So it's as ingrained into our culture then as push-ups and pulling fire hose.
Yeah, it's mental, emotional bodybuilding, right? It's the same. It's of equal, if not more, importance. And I think that when you are you said it really, really well, which is that when we do this work, when we process our traumas, when we accept that, you know, what's going on, and we work on it and we grow into highly resilient human beings. And you can measure that, because when we feel like we've processed, when we get to a state in our lives, when we've processed a lot of the things and dealt with a lot of the things that have happened to us, and we're not constantly thinking about them or worrying about them or ruminating on them, we feel safer in our own bodies every moment, and our HRV, our heart rate variability, goes up. So you can actually measure a biomarker of, which is the rate of change of your heartbeat over time, which is a proxy for vagus nerve activity of the parasympathetic recovery nervous system. And as you process trauma and feel safer in your body and do other things to feel safe in your body, regardless of whether you have a diagnosis or not, you can increase your vagal tone and increase your heart rate variability, which is the best biomarker we have of consistent peak performance, consistent injury prevention, resisting illness, overall mental and physical fitness and accuracy, and now longevity, right? Longevity and health span, it's the best biomarker. So this is like a really important biometric that we, you know, now have that we can track against, which is really exciting. But also, I think what's more important is that it's like any of us can make a decision to just start doing this work for ourselves right now by just prioritizing it. Like prioritizing, you know, like you said, having somebody to talk to is really important, but even just like having quiet time without your phone, going on, like doing things that are like nice for yourself and treating yourself well and thinking about yourself well and with gratitude and forgiveness and compassion. And there are lots of these techniques that really help. And but again, there's no doubt about it. Like, this is not easy work when you get started, which is why having somebody as a guide along the path can be really helpful. And that really, you know, gets to why we developed Apollo, because what we realized, as you said, is that when you've processed this stuff or you feel a little safer in your body, you get more resilient. And so we thought that, well, if we increase vagus nerve activity, then perhaps we can help people feel safe enough to feel their own feelings again. And if they can feel their own feelings, they can process them and then feel better on the other side faster. And that's actually now what we've seen using this technology. And I'm just wearing one on my chest right now, but you can wear it anywhere. And it uses sound wave vibrations to help us get into the same state of healing and recovery that we're talking about, that results in those performance boosts later and consistently down the road.
Well, let's expand on that. You brought Apollo to not only IHMC when we did the Blue Sky, but also you did a talk here in Ocala a few weeks ago, and I got to you know, use it again for a moment. What even sent you down the road of the science behind that? And then talk to me about the product, and let's elaborate on the applications for the people listening.
Sure. Well, it's very relevant because as a psychiatrist and researcher, I was working with patients who were primarily PTSD survivors. And most of them were traumatized military veterans or women with sexual trauma or burnt out first responders and people of that nature. And we were throwing, from the Western psychiatry approach, we were throwing the kitchen sink at these people. Like, we were doing everything we could. They'd done multiple medication trials, multiple therapy trials. Most of these people were not getting better. Like, they were still heavily symptomatic long-term. And some of them, by the time I saw them, which was like several doctors down the road, had been taking like 5 to 15 different medications and still not experiencing any consistent relief. And that was just, it's really surprising to me that we were seeing so much of that. And as I started to see more of it in my clinic, I started talking to my colleagues, and they were seeing the same thing. And then I started looking at the research, and other doctors were publishing that PTSD, and especially PTSD with adverse childhood events, is much harder to treat, tends to be much more resistant to treatment than other forms of mental illness. And that most people who ever get treated with all the treatments don't get better. So I thought, well, this is a ripe area for discovery, right? Like, if only 30% of people are getting better and 70% are still sick after being diagnosed with PTSD, like, we have a huge amount of improvement we can make in this area. So started with my patients, and the patients just didn't respond to treatment. And then as I started to learn more from these people by talking to them, you know, we're talking like hundreds, thousands of people over the years, just continually like asking them about their feelings and what they're going through and what they're struggling with and how they're coping with it and what's working and what's not working and what makes it worse and et cetera, all the things that we ask about in a mental health interview, you start to get really well acquainted with a traumatized consciousness. And you really start to see not only the similarities between people, but also the similarities between these people who I'm working with as my patients and myself, and how I deal with trauma and stress myself. And I started to realize that PTSD is a learned fear response, right? Like, we don't talk about it. We talk about it like that, but not quite all the way like that. But it's like B.F. Skinner, right? It's like learned fear with rats in the cage with the button. And you can train a rat to fear food if you associate it with something that makes food unpleasant, right? And then it will die of starvation. Like, that's really interesting. So we actually do that same fear learning to ourselves, and we have that experience in the world. And and that's what results in eventually, for many people, a diagnosis of mental illness. I think the real question is, well, then if we need to rethink this disorder of PTSD to start as fear learning, then how do you fix fear learning in animals? You relearn safety and it works, and you extinguish the fear. I'm like, well, isn't that what it says about humans? Of course, it does say that about humans, that you just have to relearn safety. And that's how our psychotherapies work. So as I'm starting to see this, I thought, well, okay, there is an opportunity here to look at, well, what are the biological correlates of fear and safety in the body? The neurobiological correlates are the fight or flight sympathetic nervous system responds to fear and puts us in a survival state when we're afraid, I mean, we could die. And then the parasympathetic rest and digest nervous system responds to safety, and they're separate and they split resources between fear response and safety response. Safety is recovery, digestion, immunity, reproduction, metabolism, sleep, all the good stuff we want to happen most of the time. Fear, the sympathetic and the fear response is what we want to happen when we're running from an immediate threat. So that, seeing those patterns, I started to realize, well, what if we just gave the, if you do safety practices, does that help with PTSD symptoms? If you do the deep breathing, the meditation, yoga, mindfulness, massage, service animals, yes, in fact, it all does. How does it work? And MDMA therapy too. And I looked at all these techniques. I mapped out the nervous system pathway to get from the technique to the brain. And I found that they all activate the emotional cortex in the brain that is response to safety. And so I thought, well, how do we send more safety to the body? Like, can we use technology for people who don't have service animals and don't have other people around to help and don't know these techniques? Can we make a technology for our traumatized veterans and first responders that can actually give them more of that safety input on the go? Will that accelerate recovery from PTSD symptoms and also just performance in general life and day-to-day life and sleep? And it turned out that it did. And so that technology is Apollo, became Apollo, and we discovered it between 2014 and 2016 at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And it just sends soothing vibrations, like gentle sound wave vibrations that you can feel noticeably, that feel kind of like an ocean wave kind of crashing up and down very slowly, or like a cat purring on your chest. And you can wear it anywhere on your body. And it sends these vibrations to the body that turn the vagus nerve activity up or down, depending on how fatigued or stressed or what state you're in and what state you want to go to. And you can use it all the time as much as you want. And it really actually is helping people with PTSD, which is really exciting.
So what are you seeing then as far as the efficacy from its inception to what you're witnessing now, 10 plus years later?
So we have, since that time, we've completed 17 clinical studies across over 2,000 subjects, most of which have been completed at independent universities. And we just send them product and our technology, and they test it in their patient populations or their healthy populations or first responders. And I think the most interesting, consistent things we see are that using Apollo within minutes, as little as 2 to 3 minutes, has a noticeable change on the body. And that's really interesting because, like, the body, and by mean body, I mean like your heart rate variability and your breath rate and your blood pressure. You can notice a change in as little as 2 to 3 minutes of just feeling the Apollo vibration on your body. And that's really interesting because that's how long it takes deep breathing to work. And that's how long it takes soothing touch to work. And Apollo is a combination of deep breathing and soothing touch. So it's working in the same time scale as measured in a double blind randomized placebo controlled trial in a very, very rigorous university lab that this is working in the same time scale, 2 to 3 minutes, as deep breathing and soothing touch, which are its origins scientifically. So that's really interesting. From there, we started to do trials in regular populations of people and ill populations of people. And we saw, I think, consistently what's most interesting across the board, whether you're looking at folks with PTSD, whether we're looking at folks with depression symptoms, with anxiety, with metastatic breast cancer or terminal cancer diagnoses, or people with severe terminal autoimmune diseases, is that there's an improvement in a core set of symptoms and metrics that are all autonomic related components. And so these are sleep improves statistically and clinically significantly between, depending on who you are, like 30 to 45 minutes a night. We see deep and REM sleep improve. We see heart rate and resting heart rate go down. Blood pressure goes down. HRV, heart rate variability, the sign that the vagus nerve is being activated, goes up. And fatigue, which can be a measure of lots of different things that happen in the body when you're overly stressed out, fatigue goes way down across all of these populations, the PTSD groups, the autoimmune groups, the cancer pain groups. Pain perception is altered. So people are still experiencing pain, but they're not experiencing quite as much pain. And the more they use Apollo, the less pain that they experience. And we are seeing borderline statistical significance there. All the other metrics I just mentioned are profoundly statistically significant, like P is less than 0.001. So that's really exciting. So it means that means that there's like no chance that this data happened by chance, particularly now that it's been replicated across multiple different study sites. So all of that's kind of the gamut of the kinds of improvements we're seeing. But I think the three things that are the most relevant to first responders are, number one, the benefits of this happen in as little as one night. That is amazing. There is so little that we have, it doesn't have side effects, that works that quickly. So you can see benefits from Apollo, especially if you have a first responder, what we'll call a irregular sleep schedule. You could see benefits in as little as one night. And I think that, you know, that is something that makes this like very accessible and interesting to people, as a way to just be able to gain control over your sleep rhythms and your day-to-day recovery, which is really, as you've been alluding to, centered around sleep.
Absolutely. Yeah, your technology, NewCom is another one I think is phenomenal. When we get these work weeks to where they're healthy, and then we teach people all these tools to get the most out of their rest days as well. I mean, you know, we would revolutionize health in my profession. There's no question. One more area, because I know we've only got a few minutes left. I've had Jonathan Edwards on talking about ketamine, and Catherine Walker as well. Dr. Ben Sess has been on a couple of times talking about MDMA and psychotherapy with that. I've talked about ibogaine, ayahuasca, I mean, all these different ones. Which are some of the psychedelic side that's exciting you the most?
I mean, I think it's like the whole thing, right? I think one of the things that I teach about that a lot of other people don't teach about for whatever reason is what is the common mechanism of how psychedelic medicines, when combined with therapy, facilitate healing and access to transformation, right? What is the common ground? Regardless of whether it's ketamine or MDMA or ayahuasca or psilocybin or LSD, what do they have in common? And what's interesting is they actually have, when we think about it from that perspective, quite a lot in common. And then when we separate them all by molecular structure and try to focus on like, how are these molecularly working and try to ground up, understand the mechanism, it's not as interesting as understanding phenomenologically what happens, right, when you take these different medicines. Starting out with the fact that ayahuasca, one of the oldest known psychedelic brews that's still used by indigenous cultures, was originally, when we asked, we went down to Peru to talk to one of the oldest Shipibo tribes and talk to the shamans and understand from them what they were using ayahuasca for and how they used it in their own language. And the single word answer when I asked him, like, what are you using this for? Like, why, what do you use ayahuasca for? Single word answer, trauma. And to them, trauma means the energetic blockages that prevent our energy from flowing freely, from our human essence from being free. And so they are helping when they, as they see it, like they're using and working within that, with that medicine. And there's a whole lot more to it than this, but in the medicinal sense is to help process trauma, help the individual process their trauma and resolve it to become, grow into a more resilient, higher version of themselves. Fast forward to today with MDMA and ketamine therapy and psilocybin therapy, we are using the same techniques with a modern Western adaptation to treat trauma. It's not with a shaman, it's with a doctor or somebody like me, with therapist colleague, and we create a foundation of trust to guide you into your subconscious, unconscious material in a setting where you feel safe enough to allow whatever to come up and work with it. And then allow, as you start, and as people start to notice that they start to become more accepting of what happened and release fault and let go of past regrets and all that kind of thing, they feel more free to be themselves. They feel more free in general, right? So like we're doing the same stuff. And what's even more interesting to me is that the effect of psychedelic medicines, when you look at the, is like, what do these represent in the path of the evolution of modern medicine, right? Because we've been treating, as I mentioned in the beginning of this interview, we've been treating mental illness the same way for the last 50 years. And before that, it was just psychotherapy, basically no drugs. Then it was just drugs and basically no psychotherapy for the next 50 years. Now we have a combination of all of this stuff happening and we have psychedelic medicine entering the scene. And psychedelic medicines, unlike our traditional Western pharmaceuticals for mental health, you don't take every day. You take 3 to, you know, anywhere from 1 to 6 or 1 to 12 doses a year, depending on the drug, with intensive psychotherapy accompanying it and in between, and you get to long-term remission. And in the MDMA trials with severe PTSD, you get to long-term remission from just 3 doses and 42 hours of therapy that gets even better 1 year out without additional treatment.
Yeah.
So I think that is nothing to scoff at. Right? Like we don't see that kind of improvement in mental illness in any, with any modern treatment or any past treatment ever. The only way to go find something as a medication or treatment that works in that way, where you treat somebody over 1 to 12 weeks and then they get better and then they get even better 1 year later. The only kinds of things that are drugs that work like that are antibiotics, right? Antifungals, things of that nature. And similarly, you also have to use those for 1 to 12 weeks, depending on how bad your infection is, right? And you also have to do aftercare, and you also have to protect the wound or wherever the infection is, right? You have to take care of yourself or the infection won't go away. And the antibiotics work by helping weaken the bacteria so that your body is more able to easily fight it and kill it. They don't actually kill the bacteria for us. They just weaken it so that our body can kill it. What do psychedelics do? They weaken the meaning around trauma, traumatic events, right? They loosen the association of there must be something wrong with me because this happened. It weakens the power that we've given to that past traumatic event that's happening. The past traumatic event is still what happened. It's still the same. What's different is that now we're able to process it and digest it more easily and break it down and then spit it out the other side because it doesn't seem so scary. Does that make sense?
No, it does completely. I think this is the creation of this podcast initially is there are so many solutions now. There just are. There's a lot of stigma around some of them. There's just misinformation or you know, smacks against what we thought was illegal or immoral in the past. But now it's just the storytelling, getting people to understand that, you know, the how important sleep is, and the rest and recovery between shift work, if that's what you do. And then using psychedelics if you're not able to access trauma, and finding forgiveness. And then, you know, CBD, and it just, the list goes on and on and on. And then obviously the technology, you know, Apollo Neuro and NuCalm and some of these other incredible technologies that we're using, modern tech now, to address age-old solutions as well. So I know we've come at the end of the hour. For people listening then, where can they find Apollo? And then where are other places they can learn more about you and reach out?
Thank you again for having me. And I think just to put the closure on this, I think between, to answer your question in full, between technology and psychedelics, I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, we will, if we focus on what I was just talking about, we will start to see actual cures for mental illness emerge in the next 5 to 10 years. We're that close, but we have to focus on developing and studying effectively and disseminating the technology and the psychedelic medicine approaches thoughtfully, respectfully, properly, right? It can't just spread it all out there with no regulation, no guidance. Like, it has to be delivered correctly to get the outcome. So it has to be used correctly to get the outcome that we're talking about. But I think that's the exciting light at the end of the tunnel. That's the shining star, right? Is getting to a time where we can actually start curing mental illnesses like PTSD, depression, anxiety, and maybe many others. And we're not that far away. Again, thank you so much for having me. This is such an exciting topic to talk about. If anybody wants to come find me, you can find Apollo at apolloneuro.com. That's APOLLONEURO.com. If you can't remember that, you can go to wearablehugs.com, which is what the kids call it. And if you have an iPhone and you want to try Apollo for free, you can just download the Apollo Neuro app to your iPhone. Apollo Wearable works with all platforms, but we have a free version that you can try on iPhone now. So if you have an iPhone, try it out. Just download the Apollo Neuro app from the App Store. And then if you want to come find me, I am at drdave.io. And you can find my clinic and all of the work that I do, and my podcasts that I work on, which are The Psychedelic Report, which comes out every couple of weeks on Spotify and Apple, and also Your Brain Explained, which is a consciousness show about how your brain works, which also comes out about quarterly on Apple and Spotify.